From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, Adam McKay. He wrote and directed the new film Vice, which is nominated for 6 Golden Globes. It stars Christian Bale as Dick Cheney and traces his rise from flunking out of Yale to serving as George W. Bush's powerful vice president. Cheney survived 5 heart attacks and a heart transplant. 1 week after McKay finished filming Vice, McKay had a heart attack. He says he recognized his symptoms only because of a conversation he had with Christian Bale on set.
So I called Christian Bale a week later and I said, either you or Dick Cheney just saved my life.
Vice is a comedy that draws on investigative journalism. McKay also made Anchorman and The Big Short. Later, linguist Jeff Nunberg explains a communications breakdown at the Mexican border between Border Patrol agents and asylum seekers. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Adam McKay, wrote and directed the new movie Vice, which is nominated for 6 Golden Globes, more than any other film. The movie stars Christian Bale as Dick Cheney and covers Cheney's years from the time he flunked out of Yale to his 8 years as President George W. Bush's vice president, when Cheney used various means to turn himself into perhaps the most powerful vice president in American history. Vice draws on the work of investigative journalists and combines that with some speculation and comedy. In that respect, it's similar to McKay's previous film, The Big Short, about what led to the financial crisis of 2008. McKay has also made straight-up comedies like Anchorman and Talladega Nights. He's a former head writer of Saturday Night Live. He directed Will Ferrell's 2009 one-man Broadway show satirizing George W. Bush. McKay also co-founded Funny or Die and the improv group Upright Citizens Brigade. Getting back to those 6 Golden Globe nominations, they include Best Motion Picture Musical or Comedy Acting nominations for Christian Bale as Cheney, Amy Adams as Lynn Cheney, and Sam Rockwell as George W. Bush, and nominations for McKay for his writing and directing. Let's start with a scene from Vice, when George W. Bush asked Cheney, who at the time was CEO of Halliburton, to be his vice presidential running mate.
I want you to be my VP. You're the solution to my problem.
I'm CEO of a large company. I have been Secretary of Defense. I have been Chief of Staff. The vice presidency is mostly a symbolic job.
Right, right. I can see how that wouldn't be enticing to you.
However, the vice presidency is also defined by the president. And if we were to come to a different understanding.
Uh-huh. Go on. I'm listening.
I sense that you're a kinetic leader. You make decisions based on instinct.
I am. Mm. People always said that.
Yeah, yeah. Very different. Very different from your father in that regard. Now, maybe I can handle some of the more mundane jobs, overseeing bureaucracy, managing military, energy, foreign policy.
That sounds good.
Adam McKay, welcome back to Fresh Air and congratulations on the film. Cheney has a legacy. He was one of the most powerful vice presidents in American history. How are his accomplishments still with us, for better or worse, depending on your political point of view?
I mean, there's no question Cheney is a brilliant bureaucrat, a brilliant operator. He has a patience and an intelligence in viewing Washington, D.C. and how the gears of power work. What Cheney conditioned us to get comfortable with was the idea of, you know, extraordinary rendition, extreme interrogation, these ideas that 20, 30 years ago would have been considered outlandish, suddenly were very comfortable to the American people. And then the biggest thing he did was by going to war, and then in the end turned out the intelligence was bogus, which I think if you're right wing or left wing, I think you have to agree that was the case, and how America just moved on from that. And I think at that point we started to get comfortable with the fact that our government wasn't entirely working for us, and that there were agendas inside our government that didn't represent the will of the people. So I think in an abstract sense, he changed the way we view government. But then in a very tangible sense, I mean, let's face it, the Middle East became completely destabilized. You had the rise of ISIS. You know, they tripled the debt. And then obviously the world economy collapsed. And they were really the first administration to nakedly put lobbyists and corporate insiders in regulatory jobs.
So we're talking pretty seriously about former Vice President Dick Cheney's legacy. Your film is not only a kind of historical look back at Cheney, but it's an entertainment. I mean, it's funny, it's lively, and it's not a documentary, you know, and it's not a straight out drama by any means. So you had to find a tone, like you had to do with The Big Short. You had to find a tone to tell a complicated story that has had a profound effect on the world, and to do it in a way that's entertaining and that's, you know, fun to watch, and that's fast paced, yet you can absorb the information that you're getting. So what kinds of things did you have to think through before figuring out what is the tone? What is the structure? How do you pull this off?
A lot of it comes from the fact that I do this research, and a lot of it looks very dry and seems not that interesting. And then I'll find things like that Dick Cheney had an office basically everywhere in Washington, D.C., and I'll go, holy moly, this is crazy. And I think a lot of the ways that people like Cheney have gained power is that they rely on us being bored. They rely on us looking at what they do and assuming that it's just bureaucracy and who cares. And when you really dig into it, it's very exciting stuff, and it's major stuff that changes the world. So as kind of a fan of movies, I really get a kick out of bringing that to life. So, boy, when you're talking about Dick Cheney, I mean, he really has no signature speech. There's no great Dick Cheney moment where he was in front of a pulpit delivering a great line. There's no moment of Dick Cheney sort of establishing himself as a figure in American history. He's always kind of just been in the background. And so I had to bring him to the foreground to show what he was able to do. And there's a lot of moves and a lot of stylistic leaps you can take in movies that you can't do with other mediums that worked really well with this guy.
There's a scene I want to play from fairly early in the film, and this is when Cheney is a young man. And he was, and I didn't know this about him, but apparently this is true because you say most of the stuff in the film is true. He was expelled from Yale.
Mm-hmm.
And
Yeah, his Lynn actually worked with a local businessman who was able to give out 2 scholarships to Yale every year. But back then, Yale did not accept women. And so Lynn was a straight-A student. You know, Dick Cheney was more of a B student, and she talked her boss into giving Dick a scholarship.
Huh. So did he flunk out?
There's one story he tells, and he doesn't tell a lot of stories, but there's one story he tells about being drunk at a party and riding a tricycle down a staircase, very, very drunk. And I think he partied a lot. He lost his scholarship initially. His family tried to scrape together money to keep him there, and then eventually he flunked out.
It's so hard for me to imagine Dick Cheney riding on a tricycle, drunk down a staircase. But you also, in the screenplay, have how he was arrested twice for driving under the influence. And so what happens before the scene I'm going to play is that he's arrested for driving under the influence during a time after he's flunked out of Yale and he's moved back to Wyoming. And his job at the time is kind of hanging power lines in Wyoming. So he's doing a lot of, like, climbing poles to hang power lines. So after he's arrested for driving under the influence, Lynn Cheney reprimands him and basically gives him an ultimatum. So here's that scene, and Lynn Cheney is played by Amy Adams, and Christian Bale is Dick Cheney.
2 times. 2 times! I have to drag you out of that jail like a filthy hobo.
I'm sorry, Lynn.
What? What did you just say?
I'm sorry, Lenny.
You're sorry? Don't call me Lenny. You're sorry. 1 time is I'm sorry. 2 times makes me think that I've picked the wrong man. You already got your ass thrown out of Yale for drinking and fighting. And now you're just going to be a lush that hangs power lines for the state? Are you going to live in a trailer? We're going to have 10 kids? Is that the plan?
Discuss this later, please.
No, we're going to discuss this right now while you smell like vomit and cheap booze.
Does Dick want some coffee?
What? Mom, get out! Get out! Does Dick want some coffee? Jesus Christ! Okay, here's my plan. Right? Either you stand up straight and you get your back straight and you have the courage to become someone or I'm gone. I know a dozen guys and a few professors at school who would date me.
I love you, Lynn.
Then prove it! Prove it! I can't go to a big Ivy League school, and I can't run a company or be mayor. That's just the way the world is for a girl. I need you. And right now, you are a big, fat, piss-soaked zero.
Okay, a scene from Vice, written and directed by my guest, Adam McKay. So where does that scene come from? What background did you use for that scene?
That is a story that Dick Cheney talks about a lot and Lynn's referred to a lot. And, you know, that was a moment where Dick Cheney had flunked out of Yale. He was working as a lineman in Wyoming. We're talking the early 60s. That's a tough town, a tough state to work in. And what would happen is they would work on the lines all day. They would, you know, climb up and put up the power lines. I think he was an apprentice lineman, actually, so maybe he wasn't fully climbing to the top of the pole. But and then at night they would go out and they would drink, like old-fashioned, you know, 19th century drinking. And he got a couple DUIs, and I think it was even a little bit more than that, too. You know, to get a DUI in the early 60s in Wyoming, you're really doing some shenanigans with your driving. So we know there was some extreme stuff going on. So, but he loved her. He loved Lynn Vincent from the second he saw her when he moved from Nebraska to Wyoming when he was, I think, 11 years old. He was crazy about her. And, you know, there are a lot of cases where your girlfriend would say that speech to you and you would go, well, too bad, I'm doing this, but not him. He white-knuckled it. And what he did, it's actually an amazing story. He stopped going into town at night and he stayed in this little crappy trailer with an old World War I veteran. And they would sit there and they would eat like canned tuna fish. And Dick would ask him stories about World War I, and that's how he stopped getting into trouble. And then eventually got back into college, went to University of Wisconsin, started doing quite well, and got on track with Lynn. And then they got married. They were actually boyfriend and girlfriend in that scene, and then later got married.
So you kind of depict Lynn Cheney as the kind of motivating factor and the power, the ambition behind Dick Cheney's initial climb.
No question. We interviewed some people from Casper, Wyoming, to this day, and they still say no matter who she would have married, would have been president or vice president, that this young lady back in those days was so smart, so ambitious, so talented. But at that time, there weren't a lot of opportunities for women, so she needed a solid guy, and she picked Dick Cheney.
So when he's in the hospital after his first heart attack during his first congressional campaign, she starts campaigning on his behalf because he can't go out and campaign. And you have her saying in a speech to a bunch of men who, you know, working men, and she says something like, women in New York right now are burning their bras, but women in Wyoming, we know what to do with our bras. We wear them. Where does that come from? Did she say that?
It's my favorite line in the movie. We looked everywhere for her speeches. We couldn't find them. We looked through all the old Wyoming papers. So at that point, you just got to go with it. And so I'm definitely having a little bit of fun there. But we do know that she was really good at campaigning and audiences loved her. And they were in a tough spot right there. You know, Dick Cheney was not a good campaigner. He had a heart attack. And Lynn was very charismatic. And she went out there and she kept their lead and he got elected. And also the big thing is she was even ahead of Dick Cheney in starting to play this idea of the cultural divide of, you know, the East Coast versus the middle of the country. And she had a very good nose for that and understood that that was a powerful tool that could be used.
Well, let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more if you're just joining us. My guest is Adam McKay. He wrote and directed the new film Vice about Dick Cheney, former vice president. Dick Cheney is played by Christian Bale. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Adam McKay. He wrote and directed the new film Vice, which stars Christian Bale as Dick Cheney. And Adam McKay also wrote and directed The Big Short, which was a film with actors, not a documentary, a film with actors about what led to the financial collapse of 2008. He wrote and directed Anchorman and Talladega Nights and other films as well, and used to be head writer on Saturday Night Live. In the early part of the George W. Bush administration, when you were head writer on Saturday Night Live and Will Ferrell was in the cast, he often played George W. Bush, even during the campaign, and you were his writing partner on that. And then after Saturday Night Live, you and Will Ferrell did a one-man show, and so it was Will Ferrell as George W. Bush on stage. Do Cheney and Bush look really different to you now than they did then, with the amount of time that has elapsed since you work with Will Ferrell on George W. Bush material?
Yeah, in the middle of that show, I really started noticing what W. Bush's position was, that he was a name. He was not a serious guy. He was, you know, by a lot of accounts, a fairly okay guy. He was fun to hang out with. And it was really clear when we were doing that show, and I think everyone kind of knew the joke beforehand that Cheney was pulling strings, but really it was during that show that I just was startled by how many decisions were made by Cheney. I started hearing all these stories. You know, the second tax cut they did for the super rich, they were at the big, you know, the table, and Cheney said, we should do a second tax cut, and Bush is like, we just did one. And Cheney goes, yeah, but that's our base. And they did it. And they did the tax cut. And there's another story where finally, you know, W. Bush has gotten Rumsfeld out and he's meeting with the next Secretary of Defense. I think it was Gates. And in the middle of the meeting, he just leans forward and he goes, W. Bush leans forward to Gates and goes, what are you going to do about Cheney? And I thought, that is a wow. That is a very telling story. Like, you're the president. Why would you? So
wait, what do you think he meant by that?
I think he meant like he didn't know how to handle him. You know, we know that Bush's father, H.W. Bush, God rest his soul, said, I never would have recommended Cheney for my son if I had known he was going to run a shadow empire out of the White House. I mean, that's an actual quote from his father. So, but that Gates story really stuck with me. I remember hearing that and just thinking like, wow, that sounds like a guy who's, I don't quite want to say afraid of someone, but can't handle someone.
During the presidential campaign between George W. Bush and Al Gore, when Will Ferrell was playing W. Bush, and you were working with Will Ferrell on writing the Bush sketches, Bush was usually depicted as a kind of bumbling, not very smart, frat boy kind of guy who drank a lot and didn't take things very seriously, liked to party and have beer. Did you have any idea in those days during the campaign that Bush would become, along with Cheney, so consequential in changing the course of American and world history?
That's the scariest single sentence I have ever heard. No. No, I did not. It was amazing. I often refer to this moment when I talk to people about when did we know that America was going down a very strange course. And once again, you know, regardless of your political opinion, whether it's right or left, I knew something was different after that first debate with Gore and Bush. We were all at 30 Rock watching it on television in one of my friend's offices. And I just thought it was embarrassing. I thought we were clearly seeing a guy who had no qualifications to be there in George W. Bush, had a 10-year gap in his employment history. That's actually true. 10 years where he didn't work at all. His first job out of college was selling tropical plants. Clearly, the only stock and trade he had was his family name. And by the way, I'm not saying Gore was perfect, but, you know, Gore is a professional. He's been around for a while. So we were watching this debate, and we were like, this is really ridiculous. And then I went and I walked around the hallways of SNL, and I saw several people, and I said, can you believe this craziness that's going on? And they went, what do you mean? I think Bush is great. And I'll just never forget the look in their eyes. And I realized at that point we had slipped into a different reality. And sure enough, you know, some people would say he didn't win, but he squeaked out a win. And I'll tell you for sure, the second time he ran, he definitely won. I mean, America definitely picked him and Cheney. That's one of the strangest moments I've ever experienced in my life.
My guest is Adam McKay. He's nominated for Golden Globes for writing and for directing the new film Vice. We'll talk more after a break, and Jeff Nunberg will tell us about a communications breakdown between Border Patrol agents and migrants from south of the border that's getting little attention. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Library of Congress with the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, a program that offers thousands of books for all ages in audio and braille formats. More at 1-800-300-6000. And from Indeed, used by over 3 million businesses for hiring, where employers can post jobs and use screener questions to build their short list of preferred candidates. Learn more at Indeed.com/hire.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with Adam McKay. He wrote and directed the new film Vice, which is about Dick Cheney and how he became one of the most powerful vice presidents in American history. It stars Christian Bale as Cheney, Amy Adams as Lynn Cheney, and Sam Rockwell as George W. Bush. They're each nominated for Golden Globes, as is McKay for both his writing and directing. McKay also made the comedies Anchorman, Talladega Nights, and The Big Short. He's a former Saturday Night Live head writer. Christian Bale is really fantastic in the movie as Cheney, particularly as the Bush-era Cheney. And some of it is the makeup and prosthetics, but he gets the voice so well and the breathing. Like, you can always hear Cheney when he's breathing, when he's inhaling before the next phrase he's about to speak. And he gets the pacing and the breathing perfectly right. And also, you know, Cheney, when he speaks, it comes out a little more on one side of his mouth than the other. And Christian Bale got that perfectly. Why did you think of him? I mean, physically, he's the opposite type of Cheney. He's got a very narrow face, or at least that's how I think of it, as opposed to Chaney's much, you know, kind of rounder or more square face. Chaney's heavier than Bale, as Bale had to put on a lot of weight for the role. Christian Bale's Australian, which I never remember when he's playing an American.
Welsh, by the way.
Welsh, okay. Yes, Welsh. Yeah, yeah. But I never remember that he's not like a native American accent speaker. So why in the world did you think of him?
I think you just said it. I didn't really care about him looking exactly like him. I was more interested in the kind of psychological build of the character. And there are just very few actors like Christian Bale and Amy Adams that can do that kind of work where they really build a character psychologically. And so it's not just mimicking gestures or mimicking motions. They know why that motion is happening. They know why that gesture is happening. And there's a psychological history to it, and there's an evolution to it. And, man, I've never seen anything like it with this movie as far as getting to watch Christian put this character together. It's everyone on set. Every day he would walk on, there was like this quiet reverence for what he was doing. And the depth to which Bale went, wow. It's I'll never forget the first day where his weight gain mixed with the makeup, mixed with all the psychological work, mixed with all the character work, when it all came together, I just literally, the hairs stood up on my arms. I've never experienced anything like it.
So in your film, there was supposed to be a musical number that I'm sure would have been really funny. And when I read that that was supposed to be in there, I got really kind of angry because you edited it out, and I really want to see it. Okay, so it'll be a DVD extra, but how long am I going to have to wait for that? But so tell us something about the production number. You can sing it. You can sing some of the lyrics.
It was so good. It was so good. We had Brittany Howard from the Alabama Shakes. We had the choreographer of Hamilton. We had Christian Bale, Carell. It was basically Don Rumsfeld teaching Chaney neither a borrower nor a lender be, except, you know, always a borrower, always a borrower be. It was amazing. It just, tone-wise and story-wise, did not work in that part of the film, and we tried and tried and tried. It almost worked, and it definitely, I've had a little pang recently of, man, maybe I should have just left that in there. But the good news is it will be out with the, you know, when the release of the movie happens and streaming and DVD and all that kind of stuff. And it really is tremendous.
You should have called me, because here's what you could have done. Okay, so you could have, in the closed credits, had them roll over that number. So it would be kind of like an extra within the movie.
Yeah, we actually did discuss that.
So you didn't need to call me, but why did you not do that?
Because it felt weird. It felt like you're going way backwards in the movie. It felt like you're like, oh, now we're back to him as a young man. Like, it didn't quite work.
But I could have handled it.
my daughter and her friends were so pissed. They're like, how could you cut that? I may have made a mistake. I will openly admit that I may have made a mistake on that one. But, it did not quite feel right. We tried and tried. That was probably our biggest cut in the movie. I mean, the nice thing is most of the other stuff stayed in. But, that was a tough one.
So making Vice was a very eventful period for you. You had a heart attack before the movie was finished. Thank goodness you survived and seem to be in good shape now. What point of the movie were you in when you realized you were having a heart attack?
We had just finished filming. I think we had wrapped for about a week. And it's that period where the editor is putting together the rough assembly of the movie. Hank Corwin was working on it. So you kind of have this little week and a half, 2 week break. I have a company with Will Ferrell, Gary Sanchez Productions. We're always working on TV and movies. So I was doing a little bit of work producing. And I just realized I was not in the best shape. I put on weight during the movie. I was foolish enough to continue smoking. Not a ton, but I was, you know, about a half a pack a day, below half a pack a day. And I didn't feel good. My doctor was warning me. And I was working out with my trainer, and in the middle of it, my hands started tingling, and my stomach felt queasy. Well, those aren't normally symptoms you think of with a heart attack. You usually think of pain in the chest and the arm. And so I told my trainer, I go, I'm fine. I'm just tired. This is just weird. And he left. And as soon as he left, I remembered the heart attack scene we shot with Bale when he was running for Congress in Wyoming in the late 70s. And Bale had asked me, he said, how do you want to do the heart attack? Do you want it to be a pain in the arm, the chest? He goes, I could also do the queasy stomach. That's really common. And I remember asking him, like, what do you mean? I've never heard that before, queasy stomach. And he goes, oh, yeah, it's very common. And so that moment just flashed back to me while I was sitting on the couch. And I went, holy Lord. And I ran upstairs. And popped,
you like, ran upstairs. You're like, you're having a heart attack, so you run upstairs.
Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe run is not the right word.
Okay.
Stumbled, staggered.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe that's a better word.
Okay.
Yeah, careened.
Mm-hmm.
And I got upstairs and I just down 4 baby aspirin and called 911. And God bless 911. Within 3 minutes, they were there. And they had me at the hospital another 3 minutes after that. And the doctor was like, why did you take those baby aspirin? Like, I think he knew. Usually the queasy stomach thing, people don't react to that one. And I said, oh, my lead actor in our movie told me that's how a heart attack works. And the doctor said, because you acted so quickly, you have no damage to your heart. Your heart's as good as new. And then he said, not only that, you have an extra strong heart. So he said, the only dumb thing you're doing is smoking. So he said, if you stop smoking, there's no reason you shouldn't live to be 100 years old. So I have stopped smoking. That is the good news. And my heart is as good as new. But man, what a scary experience. So I called Christian Bale a week later and I said, either you or Dick Cheney just saved my life.
Did the doctor think the baby aspirin helped?
Oh, yeah, for sure. No, that's what they give you. Mm-hmm. And when I got in the ambulance, they gave me more. I mean, the aspirin thins the blood, which allows it to get around the blockage. It's definitely one of the moves you want to get. It's not going to save your life. You still have to go to the hospital, but it mitigates damage. There's no doubt about it.
Did you at any point think that your life was in danger?
You know, it's funny, you're going through an experience like that. It's such a roller coaster. You don't even really think in terms like that. It's just moment by moment, feeling by feeling. And there were a couple moments that got very intense where I thought, uh-oh. And I remember the one doctor saying when I was in the hospital, because I started to feel better. And then all of a sudden, I did not feel better. And I remember hearing a doctor going, he's having a heart event right now. And I thought, oh, man, I could really die in this moment. And the craziest thing was they took me, they call it a cath lab, which I had never heard of before, the catheter lab. And they take you in there, and that's where your heart doctor comes in, your cardiologist. And this was a guy named Dr. Henry, who's one of the best in the world, thank God. And they get to work on you, and they're going to clear out that blockage, and they did, and they were amazing. And then towards the end, I was on, you know, drugs, obviously, and for some reason, I thought it was very important that everyone at the table know that I'd just done a movie about Dick Cheney, and how ironic this is that I'm on a table having a heart attack. And of course, no one cares. But I sort of mumbled it. I was like, no, this is weird. I just did a movie about Dick Cheney. And everyone ignored me, as they should have, except one voice to my right, just after a beat, just said, Dick Cheney, great American. And I went,
this is not the point of your movie.
I went, in my mind, I was like, I don't want to argue with this guy. I think these people just saved my life. So I just went, it's complicated.
And for anybody who doesn't know, Cheney had, I think, like 8 heart attacks and a heart transplant. So, you know, the whole heart connection is very, very relevant.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I mean, at one point he had it basically a little EKG or a little jump starter in his heart. So when he would have a heart attack, it would give his heart a kick to keep it alive. And it had like a little computer in it. And I guess a couple of years after he had it put in, they were worried that terrorists could crack the computer code on his heart computer that he had in there. So they actually took that out at one point. But yeah, I think he had five heart attacks. But
if you count the transplant,
if you count the device they put in, I mean, you might be right. It might be that high. It's kind of hard to calculate. But he during the 1970s, when he was working in the Ford administration, the youngest chief of staff in history, he was smoking three packs of cigarettes a day and eating a dozen donuts every day. So. Clearly not treating his heart that well.
Well, let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Adam McKay, who wrote and directed the new film Vice about Dick Cheney, and he also wrote and directed Anchorman and Talladega Nights and the movie The Big Short, which is about what led to the financial meltdown of 2008. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Kauffman Foundation, working together with communities in education and entrepreneurship to create uncommon solutions and empower people to shape their lives and be more successful. More online at kauffman.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows and more information are at macfound.org.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Adam McKay, who wrote and directed the new film Vice, which stars Christian Bale as Dick Cheney. So your wife, Shira Piven, had a brush with mortality, too. She was in a car accident. She broke her neck. And in imaging her injuries, the doctors found a spot on her lung that turned out to be malignant, and she had to have lung surgery. How is she now?
Thank you for asking. She is 100% great. Turned out that it was a very slow-moving cancer. But boy, talk about a miracle. She went through this horrible car wreck, and they discovered this spot. And she's doing great. She's the opposite of me. She's so healthy and vibrant. So she's already doing, like, yoga and hot yoga. So she's doing fantastically well.
I think it's just so... odd that you both went through these transformative experiences at a similar time. I don't know how far apart her accident and diagnosis was from your heart attack. How far apart was it?
It was like a month and
Jeez,
a half.
Well, like nothing.
Her accident was a month and a half before her car accident where she broke her neck. And then the diagnosis was about 3 months after the heart attack. And then in the middle of this, our family dog died as well, who wasn't that old. It was like 9 and a half, 10 years old.
So you went through these life-changing experiences at basically the same time. Did it make it easier for you to talk about it with each other and to understand what it means to have, you know, a life-changing diagnosis or, you know, profoundly... transformative medical experience?
The big thing I think we both experienced when I came out of the heart attack was I just had the biggest, dumbest smile on my face for like a week where I could not stop joking around. I was so happy to be alive. And what it does is it kind of, for me personally, just reaffirms what you care about. And, you know, there's a lot of things I love in life, but one of the things I love in life is like laughing really hard. And I mean that even in the face of these tragic stories that we're talking about. I just think it's one of the great things we can do. It did make me miss the comedy. I got to be honest. It did make me feel that, like, Maybe there's something to be said about if you can come up with a raucously funny movie, that there's just something about that that's undeniable. So I definitely started talking to Farrell about maybe we have to get back in the saddle again and do another big old comedy, because there's just no better way to spend your life than like laughing every single day. So that I would say that's a change that came out of it.
Well, one more question, and this relates to Vice, your new movie about Dick Cheney. So the movie isn't about the Trump administration. It's about the Bush-Cheney administration. But are there any people from the Bush-Cheney cast of characters who have reappeared in the Trump administration, and through making Vice, you have a different understanding of who they are than you otherwise would have?
You know, a big one was in the middle of editing the movie, we had John Bolton pop up in our story of Cheney and W. Bush. And I thought, you know, maybe we should cut that. That guy, he's such a fringy kind of lunatic. Let's just get him out of here. And I swear to God, 3 days later, the Trump administration appointed him. And that kept happening throughout the movie. We kept thinking that there were these characters and these ideas that were going to go away, and they just kept popping up over and over again. But the Bolton one was really funny. I mean, my editor, Hank Corin, just couldn't believe it. He was like, we're about to cut that. I was like, well, he's back.
Yeah, so Bolton was, what, UN ambassador during
yep.
Bush-Cheney and is now national security advisor?
I believe that's correct, yeah, and known for very hawkish, very aggressive foreign policy. Recently, there's footage of him with a giant smile on his face shaking hands with Putin. That's the image I have fresh in my mind.
And he was very anti-UN when he became the UN ambassador.
Oh, yeah. Bolton's a character. There's no question. And I really thought that was the end of him, so I couldn't believe it when he popped up in the middle of that. And you know, the funny thing, too, is you see a lot of these characters from W. Bush, Cheney administration who are still out there as pundits. And you still get to hear them every day talk about their views of foreign policy. And that's also very strange to see these characters still walking the earth, espousing ideas. But it also points to the fact that really none of these stories are isolated. This is a longer arc of 4 or 5 decades. It's a bigger story and transition that's gone on in America.
Well, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you again. Thank you so much. And I'm so glad that you and your wife recover from what happened to each of you and that you're both well. And I'm sorry about your dog.
Thank you. Thank you. Although he did, his name was Pumpkin, and he had an incredible life, and we loved him like crazy, and he was a rescue. So that does give us some comfort, and always, always a pleasure to talk to you, too.
Adam McKay is nominated for Golden Globes for writing and for directing the new film Vice. The award ceremony is Sunday. After we take a short break, our linguist Jeff Nunberg will tell us about an overlooked communications breakdown at the Mexican border that can be a life and death issue for migrants. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. The tragic death of a 7-year-old girl in U.S. custody at the border last month brought to light, among other things, the communication breakdowns between border agents and asylum seekers who are speakers of indigenous languages with limited Spanish. According to our linguist Jeff Nunberg, most people aren't aware of the millions of Central Americans who speak languages other than Spanish.
Nobody should need reminding that there's more to the cultures of the lands south of the border than just tequila and tacos. But people aren't always aware that there's more to them than just Spanish, too. That was brought home a few weeks ago by the heartrending story of Jacqueline Cal, or Jackie, as people have been calling her, the 7-year-old girl who died of dehydration in U.S. custody a few weeks ago. Administration officials denied they had any responsibility for the death. Shortly after he turned himself into the Border Patrol, the girl's father had signed an English-language form saying she had no health problems, after it was explained to him in Spanish. And after that, they said, he'd been given plenty of opportunity to tell them about any changes in Jacqueline's condition. But Jacqueline's father is a subsistence farmer from a remote area of Guatemala who has limited Spanish. His native tongue is the Mayan language Quechua, which has about 1 million speakers. Journalists weren't sure what to make of that language. CNN and Reuters called it a dialect, a word that's sometimes used loosely to suggest a substandard form of speech rather than a proper language. But from a linguist's point of view, that's like referring to Russian as a Slavic dialect. A Washington Post story called it a pre-Columbian Mayan tongue, as if it were the relic of a vanished civilization rather than one of a family of languages spoken by 6 million people in Mexico and Central America. As one linguist pointed out, you may as well call English a pre-Norman invasion Germanic tongue. The fact is that the roots of every language stretch back forever. Okay, these are just the quibbles of a linguist. They certainly don't diminish the quality of the reporting of this story, but they reflect a widespread cloudiness about the heterogeneous cultural and linguistic landscape in this part of the world. Kukchi, Mam, Kiche, Achi, and so on, those are distinct peoples, each with its own language, some with hundreds of thousands or even millions of speakers, many of them monolingual. Their literacy rates are generally low, but they have their own writing systems. In fact, several of them are supported in the most recent release of Google Android. Speakers of those languages have been migrating to the U.S. for many decades, the majority legally. They're fleeing poverty, repression, gangs, and state-sponsored violence. The Northern Triangle, as it's called, of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, is reckoned one of the deadliest regions of the world. Taken together, there are more speakers of Mayan languages living in the U.S. than of Navajo, which is the most widely spoken North American indigenous language. The recent influx of migrants from the region has created the need for more interpreters. According to a 2017 Justice Department report, the Mayan languages Mam and Quiche are among the languages most often heard in immigration cases, ahead of French, Bengali, and Korean. Border agents are supposed to make use of interpreters when they have communication problems, often over the telephone. But the procedures aren't always followed. When Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen was asked at a House hearing in December whether an interpreter had been called for Jacqueline's father, she sidestepped the question and said only that the agents had done all they could. In fact, in its public communications, the DHS seems to suggest that a knowledge of Spanish is all that border agents need to do their jobs. In a press conference last June, Secretary Nielsen boasted that all U.S. Border Patrol personnel on the southwest border are bilingual, every last one of them. It's true all agent trainees are required to take an 8-week Spanish course as part of their training program, and many speak it better than that. But that may not suffice when it comes to obtaining medical information or explaining an English language form to somebody who speaks only market Spanish and may be illiterate in the bargain. A 2014 report by public health consultants found that half the adults detained at the Arizona border didn't get an explanation of the legal papers they signed in a language they understood. With all the opportunities for miscommunication, it's not surprising that Jacqueline's father and the Border Patrol agents have given very different accounts of what he told them about his daughter's health. When I talked to the University of Arizona linguist Robert Henderson, who works on these languages and is a co-founder of an organization called the Maya Health Alliance, which provides health services in the region, he told me that even those Kukchi who speak some Spanish aren't up to using it when the topic turns to medical or legal issues. Why doesn't Secretary Nielsen bring up the problems of indigenous language groups when she's talking about border security and the wall in press conferences or to Congress? Maybe because there's no place for them in the administration narrative. The wall is about the Hispanics who are threatening to infest American communities with gangs, drugs, human trafficking, and massive crime, as the president put it in a recent tweet, all the malign stereotypes that are packed into the single phrase, bad hombres. But indigenous groups like the Kukchi and the Mam don't conjure up the same baleful specters. In fact, those people aren't Hispanics in the first place, no more than Inuits and Navajos are Anglos. Never mind that people like Yaclin's father aren't bad, they're not even hombres.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at the University of California, Berkeley School of Information. If you missed our Holiday Week series of favorite interviews from 2018, you can find them on our podcast, where you'll also find all the interviews we do in 2019. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Muj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and in developing countries, and working to inspire and enable the next generation of inventors. More information is available at lemelson.org. And from Capital One, committed to reimagining banking, offering savings and checking accounts that can be opened from anywhere. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A.